Russian forces have launched multiple drone attacks against Ukrainian military targets in the Donetsk region. Meanwhile, fighting is raging on in Donbass's Severodonetsk. According to Ukrainian officials, Russian forces are in control of most of the city, and this while the Eurozone is beginning to feel the pinch of a new record inflation as a result of the war. Inflation is at multi-decade highs in several major European economies, including in Germany and France. It also remains persistently high in the United Kingdom and the United States. Welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Behruz Najafi, and these are our guests in today's episode of the Spotlight. Spokesman of the LaRouche organization, Harley Schlanger from Potsdam, Germany. Journalist and political analyst Fred Ware in Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now, let me start with Harley. Given the recent military gains by Russian forces in Ukraine, as we just heard in the news, where do you expect this war to end up in?
Well, the question is whether the government of Ukraine will allow itself to continue to be used as a battering ram at the expense of its own population against Russia. The intent of the United States and NATO is regime change in Moscow. And they're going to do everything they can, as several spokesmen for the Biden administration have said, to bleed Russia with sanctions, with more weapons, and so on. Meanwhile, the idea that they're defending sovereignty and democracy in Ukraine is proving to be a complete joke. So I think what's going to happen is that the appetite in the West for continuing to provide weapons in a losing cause is going to have political blowback, especially, as you mentioned, with inflation, with economic problems, with the effects of the oil embargo that they're trying to pursue, and so on. So the real question is, how much longer will the Ukrainian forces hold out? And this is this has been, since the beginning of the war, the real issue.
Okay, let me ask, put the same question to Fred. Fred, where would this eventually end up in?
Well, right now we're in this phase where things are being decided on the battlefield. Mm. Neither side really is ready to go to a negotiating position. Both sides have some expectation of victory. I think on the Ukrainian side, it is being definitely finessed by their Western partners, especially the United States, which does seem to want to use Ukraine as a battering ram against Russia. The United States is trying to exploit this situation globally in a lot of ways to reestablish, as they see it, the unity, pro-Western, pro-American unity. And so we're not going to see a negotiated solution, which is really the only way out. The only way for this to end, and the sooner the better, is for them to come to some kind of realistic deal.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Harley, on Monday, the EU agreed to ban Russia's seaborne oil imports and to slash its bank system from the SWIFT system. And the sixth round of sanctions on Russia has sent Brent crude prices soaring. They're not, you know, it's not selling at $122 per barrel. So is Europe benefiting from the anti-Russia sanctions is imposing this way or losing?
No, this is a suicidal lunacy for Europe. You know, here in Germany, we have a situation where gas prices, because of the taxes and the local situation, gas is becoming unaffordable for many working families. The inflation rate is soaring, and the inflation rate is not simply a result of the war. The West is trying to blame it on Putin, but the inflation was there before this started, and it's there because of the quantitative easing policy, the pumping of liquidity into a system which is not functioning. It's bankrupt. So the idea that somehow you're going to bring Moscow to terms by cutting the oil shipments, you know, Moscow has other partners, other countries that will buy the oil. The Europeans have no other place to get the energy they need. I think the idea of getting natural gas from the United States when you don't even have capabilities to store it in Germany, for example, is silliness. And the austerity that this is going to force, it's not just that it's going to raise prices, it's going to affect the ability of these economies to continue to run. The auto sector, the machine tool sector in Germany and France, also in Italy. So they're all feeling a pinch. And so the idea that this is somehow going to bring down Russia, which is what Ursula von der Leyen said when she announced this, is just silliness.
Right. Fred, what do you think? How far could these Western sanctions against Moscow go? Are they worth it?
I think that they can go further. But it's true that there's a tremendous amount of blowback. They're not well thought out. The idea was that they would just pile on all these sanctions at the beginning and Russia would crumble. Mm-hmm. That is not happening. I live in Moscow. I don't see any real change in my life as an average consumer. Okay, prices are up. There is inflation. Otherwise, grocery stores are well stocked. All the consumer services are in place. It's not hitting the average Russian. It's hitting maybe people like me who have Western connections. I bank in the West. I'm screwed in a lot of ways by Western sanctions, but I'm not the guy they were supposed to be aiming at. And in general, things like embargoing oil is going to raise the cost of oil, the price. It's going to jump again, which means that Russia can afford to sell less of it on world markets because it's a, what do you call a fungible commodity? You can sell it here, you can turn it around and sell it there, and they'll just sell more there at higher prices. So I don't see how this hurts Russia. A lot of the sanctions backfire, especially on Europe, not so much on the United States, which never had much in the way of economic relations with Russia, but in Europe, they are dismantling a lot of fundamental things that they need, and they're being disproportionately hurt, even more than Russia is, by this new sanctions regime.
Right. Now, Harley, in response to sanctions, Russia's Gazprom has turned off its supplies to Netherlands because it's refused to pay for its gas in rubles. Then also we have Denmark could also see a halt in its gas supplies. And as you know, Russia has already stopped supplies to Bulgaria, Poland, and Finland. So what should we be expecting at the end of the day?
Well, the question is how long will the people of Europe sit by and watch their governments cut the economies that they live in? You know, this is I think the report from Moscow is interesting because one of the other things about the Russian economy is it's not just oil. The view in the West among people like the CIA director in the United States, like the Biden team, Blinken, Sullivan, and others, is the Obama line that Moscow is just a gas station pumping oil and gas. But Russia also exports almost 20% of, or more than 20% of the world's nickel, 19% of semi-finished iron. We know in terms of grain and fertilizer the importance of the Russian economy. So the more they cut off from Russia, the more damage will be done to the populations of Europe. Now, this, at a certain point, will have a price, because you have governments like the government in Germany is a very unstable coalition. Scholz, the chancellor, only got 26% in the election, and he's dependent on an alliance with the Greens and the Free Democrats. In France, Macron, if you figure the low turnout, Macron only had a quarter of the vote from the people who could have voted. So these are weak governments. They also have very different approaches to Russia. You had Macron and Scholz talking to Putin. Draghi from Italy was talking to Putin. They're all sort of trying to work certain angles. But the problem they have is they don't have a military solution. And that's what they're still trying to do, is cripple Russia militarily and financially. And I think the Russians are, their economy is strong enough and the military is strong enough to survive this. The question is Ukraine or are the governments of Europe?
Okay. Now, Fred, Germany is trying to create this huge army, as they call it, within NATO in the midst of this Russia-Ukraine war. So in your opinion, what direction is NATO moving and how do you anticipate the prospect of security in Europe?
I think that's all an open question. Things are changing very fast. History is rushing back in a lot of ways. I understand that the view in Washington is to reinstate the old Cold War paradigm. And so far, there's an argument that European unity, especially NATO, are getting their mojo back. And, you know, Finland and Sweden want to join. But this is a different time, and the geopolitics are really very different and much more fragile. I can't say how things are going to go, mm-hmm. but fully rearmed Germany was not the thing that the post-war American perspective was for. And I don't think that Europe is going to look all that favorably on a rearming Germany down the road. A lot of things are changing fast and in ways that we can't predict.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Harley, one basic question. NATO, maybe the raison d'etre for NATO being formed in the first place decades ago was to check Soviet Union and, you know, protect itself maybe from any likely threat. But what about now? What's NATO's mission these days? There is no more Soviet
Union. Well,
it depends
on who you ask. But if I may first just say one thing about what Fred was saying.
Sure, go ahead.
The problem that you have in Germany, and I just met today with some people on the Bundestag Finance Committee, they're trying to figure out how they can justify the huge increase in defense spending when they don't have money for infrastructure. The German rail system is in a state of breakdown. There are bridges collapsing in parts of Germany. And so if you put more money into war, you're taking it away from teachers. My son's school is cutting back in the number of teachers they have here in Potsdam. So it's a very fragile situation. And secondly, the rest of the world, the southern world, the former non-aligned nations, former colonial nations, are not in for this NATO-US ride. So that in itself is a very difficult thing. In terms of the way the U.S. is looking at it, I agree they have this Cold War scenario, but their view is NATO should become a global enforcer. And this is the idea, the global Britain, for example, of Boris Johnson, includes a global NATO. And they're preparing now the next phase, which is to contain China. Now, this, for the American military, is a real challenge, because their whole view in the past has been, we can fight Russia or we can fight China, but not both. And they try to split the two. It's not going to work. Russia and China have primarily an economic alliance, but also a military alliance.
Okay.
Is the United States prepared to fight a two-front war when we had the fiasco in Afghanistan and Iraq and so on? So I think this idea of NATO as a global force is not going to function. And the British have another idea. Boris Johnson is talking about a new Commonwealth, which would unite Britain, Poland, Ukraine, and the Baltic states, and maybe bring in Turkey. But what we can see from Turkey is Erdogan is not so anxious to jump into this fire. So I think most of their planning is based on delusional views that, that Russia is weak and that Europe is united. And I think the unity of Europe is going to start cracking.
Okay, Fred, do you share the same views as Harley?
Well, not with the same certainty, but as I said, unpredictable times. We also have to watch Poland and Hungary. Mm. If Ukraine, the Ukrainian state, starts to fail, I think you will see, I think the groundwork is being laid for Polish intervention into the Western Ukraine, which used to be part of Poland. There's a long, long history there. And as I said, history is rushing back into the vacuums that are being created by this these really terrible events. I don't want to understate just how badly this war has shaken all everything we thought we knew about European security architecture. a lot of blame to go around for it, and it's not over yet. But I sit at the nexus of, you know, all the information streams and follow it obsessively, and I think people underestimate how destructive this war is, and just the horrific casualties that are being experienced on both sides. Yeah. But Ukrainian nation is being undermined demographically, economically, and its statehood is, if this goes on, its very statehood is going to fall into question.
Okay, Harold, let me ask you about the U.S. Where is the U.S. in this? Has it achieved what it wanted to, or is it losing things? You know, Biden is just blaming, as he put it, 70% of the rising fuel prices in the U.S. on this Ukraine-Russia war.
Well, there was a Reuters poll the other day that said that 80% of the American people think the nation is going in the wrong direction. Now, here's an example. $40 billion was the new arms package that Biden got through the Congress with very little opposition from either party. Mm-hmm. And yet, American mothers can't get baby formula. American teachers are not getting paid. Hospitals are short-staffed. The infrastructure bill, which was supposed to be Biden's signature policy, is not being funded. So I think there's a great deal of anxiety in the population. Often you find, because of the anti-Russian sentiment in the American people, that can be ginned back up, at least initially, in the idea of a war. But the demonization of Putin is not quite the same as the old Soviet Union. And you may remember in 2016, Donald Trump won an election when he said he wants to end these endless wars and wants to be friends with Russia. Right. I think there's still some sentiment for that. And I think the American people have been through more than 20 years of wars. We just had Memorial Day where we celebrated or commemorated the casualties of America's wars. And since 2001, most of those casualties have been wars that should not have been fought. So I think the question in the United States, it's still to be determined. The problem is there's no real leadership pushing an anti-war position in either party. And that's why the population is not reacting more aggressively against it.
Mm-hmm. And Fred, one last question I want to put to both of you. Who do you believe is going to be the main loser of this Russia-Ukraine war? Who is benefiting most from it?
Well, if you're asking me, Ukraine is the big loser. I mean, it is, as I said, Ukraine is just taking such a terrible beating. And in so many ways, it's not just the Russians who are now gaining on the battlefield and really inflicting punishment. I mean, it's just terrible. It's on both sides. I mean, the Ukrainians are fighting well, don't get me wrong. They're fighting with quite a lot of spirit, and 8 years of NATO training is paying off for especially the regular army. But at the end of the day, the outflow of people from Ukraine, it was already hollowed out demographically before this war happened, and now millions of people have left, and many of them are never coming back. Men in the certain, you know, able-bodied age bracket are being severely injured or killed. This is devastating for Ukraine. It's not good for Russia either. Like, I have a lot of friends who are like very pro this operation. A lot of Russian friends who have gotten behind it for reasons I don't fully understand, but this is bad for Russia as well. Mm-hmm. I think that the big winner will be the United States, at least geopolitically. So far, they look like the ones whose industries are profiting enormously off of this, the reorientation of a lot of public money to military effort. I mean, it's mind-boggling to think that the United States has spent now about $54 billion in the past 3 months to given to Ukraine. I mean, it's not all delivered yet, but $54 billion is more than Russia's annual military budget. It's just a mind-boggling amount of money that's being pumped into Ukraine, but that's profiting mainly American industries and the Pentagon, and very little of it will be seen by average Ukrainians.
Okay.
So yeah, the United States is the big winner here so far.
Harley, big loser, big winner? We have 1 minute.
Well, I think I have great sympathy for the people of Ukraine, but I think the government of Ukraine has to take responsibility for that. I think the military-industrial complex is gaining in the United States, but I don't think it helps the United States. I think the United States is being seen around the world as a hypocrite, talking about democracy and freedom, while it's using the Ukrainian people as a battering ram and Ukraine as an aircraft carrier against Russia. So I think the U.S. image is going to be badly tarnished by this, just as it was by the Iraq War and the Afghan War.
Uh-huh. Okay. On that note, we come to the end of this episode of The Spotlight. Thank my guest, spokesman of the LaRouche Organization, Harley Schlanger, in Potsdam, Germany. Journalist and political analyst Fred Ware in Moscow.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the pillars of purposeful friendship. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the pillars of the purposeful friendship in the Islamic lifestyle. When we say that the friendship should be purposeful, obviously we should see some basics, and there are some pillars of that purposeful friendship. The first thing which should be seen is the friendship itself, that we need to have love between each other. We need to have a friendship. We need to have a coordination with each other. So when we choose a person as a friend, so the main thing is the friendship, that there should be a friendship. And in this friendship, what we are calling like it needs to be having the friendship is that we need to have this friendship in all areas. For example, if I believe in something, he must also believe in that. For example, if I'm monotheist, I believe in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and I love Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he should have the love of Allah as well. And if I am inclined towards something, he must be inclined towards that thing. And the commonalities should be at a vast area, that we commonly basically believe in the same things that everyone does. So that's why. And Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salatu wasalam, or even in the Quran, it is said from the Quran, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said that إِنَّمَا يَنْهَاكُمُ اللَّهُ عَنِ الَّذِينَ قَاتَلُكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ, and you cannot have the friendship with those who are enemies with you in the religion, that who does not, you know, believe what you believe, and they kick you out of your houses if they get the chance. So therefore, we cannot have the friendship with the ظالمين. And why? Because we do not have friendship. We do not believe on the same things as the others do. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the pillars of purposeful friendship, and we said that the first pillar is the friendship itself, that we need to have this friendship. And the second pillar is to be sync with each other. For example, if I have a goal to achieve, the goal that I have, he should be synced with me in that goal so that I can achieve it. I can have this friend. Why? Because I'm investing my time with him. I'm spending my time. And this investment of time should be in a way that if he is synced with what I believe, if he is synced with the purpose that I have, then obviously we both will have this journey of achieving this goal. And that is the reason that it is necessary to be synced together. So when we talk about the pillars, we need to have this friendship and we need to have this being synced with each other. And if this is all together, then obviously we can have a happy life. When we are spending time with a friend, we can have a good time. And this good time will also assure or guarantee our hereafter. Why? Because if we are synced together, if we have the same beliefs, if we are following the same goal, and whatever we are doing, if it is for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if I'm having this friendship for the sake of God, and he is having the friendship for the sake of God, then obviously we all are getting linked with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and therefore we can achieve everything easily and smoothly. And Allah also helps us. And therefore, it is necessary then that when we talk about the friendship, it should be purposeful, it should be for the sake of God. And when we make friends for the sake of God, Allah helps us and Allah makes this friendship a firm bound between two people, and therefore we can have the happy life, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Monday, head of the Iranian Islamic Seminaries, Ayatollah Ali Reza Arafi, held meetings with the head of the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and high-ranking prelates at the Vatican. The prominent Iranian cleric presented the pontiff with refined artifacts from his hometown of Meybod in Yazd province and the holy city of Qom. After that, the two religious personalities held private talks. Iran and the Vatican established full diplomatic ties in 1954, and the bond has remained uninterrupted ever since. Not many reflect on the fact that Iran and the Vatican both represent spiritual traditions that have much more in common than might initially come to mind. Ayatollah Arafi's visit to the Holy See coincided with the commemorations of the 33rd anniversary of the demise of Imam Ruhollah Khomeini, the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran. On Sunday evening, Arafi paid a visit to the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center, where he met with members of Rome's Shia community. Here, the cleric attended a commemoration of the late leader of Iran's 1979 revolution.
All thinkers who came before Imam Khomeini had predicted an end for the age of spirituality, and faithful from all religions, including the Muslims, had lost hope in the spiritual ways of living. Imam Khomeini took Islam and all religions to a more elevated spirituality, restoring their hope.
The commemoration held at the Imam Mahdi Islamic Center was also attended by Iran's diplomats and representatives of Rome's Palestinian community. There was much anticipation at the center for Ayatollah Arafi's visit.
Ayatollah Arafi's visit to Italy and to our center is very meaningful. We are honored to have him with us, and this spurs us to further study the thinking of Imam Khomeini and to ask ourselves what the role of the Shias is in the community.
In November 2020, Ayatollah Arafi sent a letter to the Holy See in which he expressed his concerns regarding the insults made against the Prophet Muhammad and the hatred expressed by some magazines, journalists, and political figures in different societies. In response to this letter, 3 months later, Pope Francis replied to the Iranian cleric, saying he is concerned for those affected by aggression and insults of religious figures, symbols, and sentiments. Max Civili, Rome.
Families of prisoners and their advocates staged a sit-in inside the office of the International Committee of the Red Cross in the blockaded Gaza Strip. Their action was in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails and detention centers, including more than 500 administrative detainees. Palestinian administrative detainees have been boycotting Israeli regime courts for more than 5 months to protest their administrative detention. Administrative detention is incarceration without trial or charge and has no time limit.
Administrative detainees are subjected to extreme suffering inside Israeli jails. They've been boycotting Israeli courts for more than 150 days to protest the detention without charge. Administrative detention is a racist policy and only causes pain and suffering to Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners suffer from inhumane treatment inside Israeli jails and are being denied basic rights. Since the beginning of this year, Israeli regime forces have arrested some 3,000 Palestinians, including children and women.
Administrative detention is a systematic policy by the Israeli regime to hold Palestinian prisoners behind bars without trial for a very long time. Administrative detention can be renewed indefinitely, and it inflicts psychological pressure on the prisoners. We have all suffered from administrative detention inside Israeli jails.
During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Ministry of Detainees Affairs slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
We call on all international human rights organizations to come out of their silence and exert pressure on the Israeli regime to stop the inhumane administrative detention policy. Palestinian prisoners are freedom fighters and must be treated according to international laws and norms. The Israeli regime is violating conventions regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Rights activists say Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails will continue to suffer as long as the world keeps turning a blind eye to Tel Aviv's violations of their rights.
According to Palestinian prisoners' advocacy groups, the Israeli regime has arrested around 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Most of these detainees have been held with no charge or trial. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The UN bodies warn that factors connected to malnutrition in Afghanistan are going up every month. Millions are struggling with poverty and hunger, and thousands of others are going unemployed. Rising prices are adding to the difficulties of families to provide food.
All these 200 people are unemployed, including me. We have to pay for our houses' rents, treatment, and medications, and provide food for our families. I have a family of 10. We can't afford flour, oil, or rice due to soaring prices. Most of us can't even have a single meal per day. We should have jobs or receive relief funds.
With the given situation, UNICEF warns that 1.1 million Afghan children are expected to suffer from severe acute malnutrition this year. Officials at the Indira Gandhi Children's Hospital said that the number of malnourished children in Afghanistan is rapidly increasing, and urgent action is needed to avert the catastrophe.
The increasing number of children at risk of malnutrition is published, which is more than 1 million. What should be done? I urge the UN and international bodies to help Afghans avert this disaster. I hope they consider us as a member of the international community and give us our rights. In particular, we need them to free our frozen funds and separate the health sector from politics.
Due to poverty, most Afghan mothers do not have proper nutrition during pregnancy. Neither can afford enough after birth.
I used to give my child some bread and tea. I was unable to breastfeed her because we couldn't afford food for ourselves. We are coming from poor families. Her father is left jobless at home. My child was constantly losing weight and cried a lot. I knew it was all because of hunger, so I brought her here.
After the Taliban seized power in August 2021, the U.S. and its allies froze about $9 billion in Afghan assets and cut off international funding. This move has partly crippled a system that was already dependent on aid. Malnutrition is a threat to children across Afghanistan. This as the country is suffering from the shortage of medicines, with hospitals being overwhelmed by hungry babies and mothers. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
An on-release report commissioned by the UK's Home Office lays the blame for the Windrush scandal, which saw hundreds of citizens from the Commonwealth wrongly detained, denied legal rights and in some cases deported from the UK, squarely at the feet of unjust laws that deliberately target people from minority ethnic backgrounds. Officials have so far refused to make the report public, much to the ire of lawyers like Jacqueline McKenzie, who represents a sizable number of Windrush victims. She's threatening to challenge the Home Office on behalf of her clients.
We all have a right to know what's in this report. Why is it a secret? It's predicated on a need to establish what caused the Windrush scandal, to make sure that we never go there again, and also to right the wrongs. And if we can't see it, then it suggests something very sinister is going on.
The Home Office says it's making progress to becoming an open and compassionate organisation. But for those who have to deal with the fallout of their racist legislation, they're finding it hard to reconcile that statement with their own experiences.
We've got to this position after 30, 40 years of racist immigration policy, building one on top of the other, until the point now where we probably have the most discriminatory and draconian racist immigration legislation anywhere outside of Israel.
Despite thousands coming to settle from former British colonies, immigration laws, it seemed, favoured a certain type of immigrant, a trend that continues into today with the announcement that the UK will fast-track graduates from the top 50 universities, none of them in Africa, the Caribbean or Latin America.
We see that privileges were given to other groups of people, particularly people from what was described as the old Commonwealths. And effectively, there was going to be white people from Canada, New Zealand, Australia, and white South Africans, you know. So racist ideology has always underpinned this. Remember, when the Windrush boat itself was outside the Tilbury docks, a Labour Prime Minister, Clement Attlee, was actually considering sending that boat around. Remember, that's the 22nd of June 1948.
Things are set to get worse.
Secretary now has the power to strip you of your citizenship, whether you're British born or not, and have you summarily shipped out the country. So not only are they not fixing all that was wrong with Windrush, they are actually giving themselves more power to commit more of the similar sorts of abuses without being in contrary of the law.
Hopefully, forcing the Home Office to publish the so far secretive report will lay bare Britain's immigration practices for all to see. This in the hope that deep scrutiny means there can be no further repeats. Amina Taylor, London.
Shaking hands of friendship in Tehran. Tajikistan's president, Emom Ali Rahman, is on a two-day trip to Iran upon an invitation by his Iranian counterpart, Ebrahim Raisi. The first day was the busiest day, which saw the two sides signing cooperation documents in a range of fields, from energy and environment to tourism and urban development.
Today, Mr. President's visit to Iran and the signing of the new MOUs between the two countries will definitely bring about a giant leap in the two sides' relations.
Today, we also followed up on the implementation of agreements signed earlier in Tajikistan that draw the roadmap for Iran and Tajikistan's economic and political cooperation until 2030.
The two sides also talked on regional developments, both sharing the same stance that Afghanistan needs to be ruled by an all-inclusive government.
Establishing a broad-based government in Afghanistan that includes all ethnic and social groups is essential to promoting peace and stability in that country.
20 years of NATO and U.S. presence in Afghanistan has had no outcome other than war, bloodshed, and destruction, and the future of Afghanistan must be determined by the people of Afghanistan themselves.
Tajikistan has been a strong supporter of Iran's full membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, or the SCO. In September last year, the Tajik president invited Raisi to his country when Iran was finally approved as a full member of the SCO, a major bloc of Asian states that was launched in 2001 by China, Russia, and Central Asian republics, with the goal of promoting cooperation in politics, trade, and economy.
In the early days of my 10 years as president, I traveled to Tajikistan both to take part in the Shanghai summit and to visit Tajikistan. That trip was a turning point in the two countries' ties, so that today we have witnessed a fourfold increase in our bilateral trade.
Despite their historical, linguistic, cultural and religious commonalities, Tehran and Dushanbe have not maintained a remarkable trade partnership. In 2020, the trade volume between the two countries was around $57 million, down from a high of $300 million in 2013. Raisi's last year visit to Tajikistan paved the way for a surge in the two sides' economic ties, pushing the annual trade up fivefold to $130 million. The two set a target of $500 million for annual bilateral trade, despite the challenges of U.S. sanctions on Iran.
Closer ties with neighbors has been on top of Ebrahim Raisi's agenda since he took office almost a year ago, as part of his ambitions to untie his country's economy from the fate of the 2015 deal. As a country that shares many concerns and commonalities with Iran, Tajikistan is on the same page with Tehran to open a new chapter in their partnership. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Some 30,000 Israeli settlers marched through Al-Quds and its old town while chanting anti-Arab and anti-Muslim slogans as part of what's known by Israel as the Flag March that takes place annually to celebrate its occupation of the eastern parts of the Holy City in 1967.
Thousands also marched through the Muslim quarter of the old town of Al-Quds amid security deployment and restrictions against the Palestinians. Clashes broke out at the Bab al-Amud, known also as the Damascus Gate, multiple times ahead of the march. Dozens of Palestinians were wounded and arrested by the Israeli forces.
Israel is conducting a very dangerous policy. They are trying to impose the annexation of East Jerusalem, which presents a very serious violation of international law. The only way to stop the Israelis is to resist their actions, but also it is required from the whole international community to impose sanctions on Israel.
At the same time, Palestinians held counter-rallies across the occupied territories, waving the Palestinian flag and chanting anti-Israeli slogans. In Ramallah, the protesters said although the Al-Quds is occupied by Israel and surrounded by military checkpoints, it will always remain their eternal capital, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always be a Muslim sacred site.
By allowing the settlers to storm the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, the Israeli regime is trying to divert attention from its internal conflict and shift attention to the Judaization of Al-Quds. But it will fail because Al-Quds always unites all the Palestinian people. Today, we're all united for the sake of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Ahead of the march, in the morning, some 2,500 settlers stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in groups of 40 to 50 under the protection of Israeli forces. Following that, Palestinian worshippers were attacked and forced out of the compound by the regime forces.
Some around the world could argue that it's only a flag parade and nothing more. But for Palestinians, the flag march is one ugly face of Israel's occupation, domination, and seizure of their right to exist on their homeland. For Palestinians, Al-Quds is a red line, and they will always defend it with all means possible. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
It was planned as a friendly soccer match, but turned into a political dispute. Canada has unilaterally pulled out of a World Cup warm-up match it had planned with Iran on June 5th in Vancouver. Citing, quote, untenable geopolitical situation of hosting Iran, the Canadian footballing body Canada Soccer called off the match, which had sold 40,000 tickets already. Here in Iran, the move has created a whirlwind, with Iranian sports authorities calling it illegal and unsporting.
Sportsmanship and fairness is a fundamental principle in sports. Canada's decision to unilaterally cancel the fixture violates the principle. On the other hand, the move has tarnished Canada's image on the world's athletic stage, because no one would trust a country that has apathetically scrapped a formal contract.
The Iranian team was slated to arrive in Canada on Wednesday to take part in the exhibition match. Canada Soccer had said it chose Iran because the team had a similar playing style to Morocco, one of Canada's opponents, and the Qatar FIFA World Cup. But aside from missing this rare chance, Canada Soccer now has to pay the financial costs of the sold-out tickets.
It seems that Canada's unilateral cancellation of its match with Iran will produce more long-term ripple effects, as there are financial dimensions to it, not to mention the legal ramifications. Iran has now decided to sue Canada for breach of contract and, quote, politicizing sports.
Canada Soccer backtracked from holding the fixture days after Prime Minister Justin Trudeau criticized the federation for their decision to invite Iran. Tehran says this further reveals how Canada's sport is influenced by political decisions.
It's a pity that a country like Canada, which claims to be committed to the separation of politics from sports, so openly disregards this principle and mixes up political hostilities against Iran with sport. It's definitely a violation of the FIFA regulations.
Tehran has now warned of legal consequences. Iranian sports authorities say they're arranging their complaint to FIFA to seek at least $10 million in damages.
Our colleagues at the Iranian Football Federation are following up on the legal pursuit of the case. We are currently writing to the Canadian Soccer Association to seek a convincing answer regarding why they committed such a move. We will then take the case to FIFA to seek psychological and financial compensation for Canada's illegal action.
Iran says it will move forward with its lawsuit against Canada's Soccer Association to question its eligibility to host 2026 FIFA World Cup. So it seems Canada's costly decision is unfolding into many unthought-of consequences. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
It took months to prepare, but it's finally here. Civil servant Sue Gray's report into allegations of rule-breaking parties under the British Prime Minister's roof during pandemic lockdowns. A report Boris Johnson repeatedly told Britons would be a moment of truth.
It's really quite damning because it demonstrates this culture of booziness right at the heart of government, particularly at a time when the rest of the country was in extremis, being locked down. People were dying and not being able to see their relations.
Only a day earlier, revelations the Prime Minister met with Sue Gray at the beginning of the month, allegedly to try and change her mind about publishing her report. And before that, a police investigation that handed him, Chancellor Rishi Sunak, and several others a penalty. The report that blames top officials for breaking lockdown rules also comes in the wake of new photos of the PM toasting his departing head of communications during the second national lockdown, pictures that to many crossed the line. Soon after the report was published, a seemingly repentant Boris Johnson, who had initially told Parliament no rules had been broken, faced the wrath of the MPs.
Well, people stayed at home to protect the NHS. The Prime Minister was engaging in drinking and debauchery that makes a mockery of the gut-wrenching sacrifices that each and every person made. Will the Prime Minister now take the opportunity and resign?
As much as the Prime Minister hopes the country would move on from Partygate, experts say Gray's conclusions could revive calls from Conservative MPs for a no-confidence vote in him. If he lost such a vote, he would lose his job.
Many of his own backbenchers, including Mark Harper, have come out to say that he is not leading as one should lead. He is not setting the kind of example, indeed, the country needs. If the country is in a time of war, this is not the kind of example that will inspire people to follow him as a leader.
Boris Johnson has clung onto power partly because of the Russian military intervention in Ukraine that diverted political and public attention here, and he plans on keeping it that way by expediting a relief package to help vulnerable Britons through the cost of living crisis. Now, whether or not that will help him survive politically is a matter of wait and see. Saeed Bouriza, London.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Imamat yek asle zinde ast dar tarikh Islam.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned. Thank you.
انسان نسبت به ناموس خودش نسبت به کسانی که
A person must be sensitive and responsible about the affairs of his family and close relatives. Of course, this sense of responsibility must not change into suspicion. This means that a person who is after protecting his family goes to extreme, and his sense of protection changes into a sense of suspicion. This suspicion is sometimes so high that the wife or daughter of a man cannot talk to their mahram men like a brother or father.
یا فرض کنید به عنوان مثال حالا خدای نکرده انشالله این موارد کمه گوشیشو چک میکنه
For instance, some suspicious men control the cell phones of their wife and daughter. Or when at the workplace, they try to control their family in the house. All these cases have a root in suspicion and are not allowed in Islam. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in a beautiful hadith, states, "Never show sensitivity or zeal in a place where there is no room for it." Unnecessary zeal and sense of responsibility makes a healthy person unhealthy. Therefore, suspicion changes the behavior of the spouses and darkens the relations between the two. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Birth anniversary of our innocent lady of Qom. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest congratulations to you all on a very blessed day that heralds the start of celebrations of another 10 days of spiritual munificence in the Islamic Republic of Iran, known as Dahe-e Keramat. Today, the first of the sacred month of Dhul-Qa'dah, is the birthday of a very virtuous lady whose munificence continues to benefit all visitors to her shrine even after the passing of over 1,000,002 centuries. For the information of our listeners, she's none other than Hazrat Masume, peace upon her, who reposes in eternal peace in the magnificent mausoleum in the city of Qom, which is a two-hour drive from Tehran and is second most important holy site of pilgrimage in Iran. The most blessed place in Iran is, of course, the grand holy shrine in Mashhad, Khorasan, of her illustrious brother, Imam Reza, peace upon him, the Prophet's 8th infallible heir, who was born on the 11th of Dhul Qa'dah, that marks the end.